We're standing in Jim Dine's studio, which is incredibly busy. I can see tables full of paint, brushes. The floor is splattered in paint. And the room is divided, if we can call it a room, more like a warehouse, it's divided into three spaces. So I'm excited to tour about and see what Jim does in each of these separate spaces.
Ever since he emerged as an avant-garde artist in the early 1960s, Jim Dine has immersed himself in an intense search for his own identity, using everyday objects infused with meaning to carve out his autobiography. Hearts, bathrobes and paintbrushes are among his signature images, but tools are the subject he's been working with the longest.
His vocabulary is in tools, so he uses every possible tool you could find in a hardware store. Pliers, hammers, saws, you name it, they appear in his prints.
That section was just like being inside a workshop with all the tools and the battery packs.
But it is my workshop.
Exactly, exactly.
Propped up around us are some of his paintings bursting with colour, as well as poems that Jim has scrawled directly onto the studio wall. But there are also tables of prints, and it'd be difficult to find anybody for whom printmaking is so important.
He is completely in love with printmaking. He has to do it.
Gosh, it's like a TARDIS. It just unfolds space after space.
Well, back here is where I've always printed. By hand, woodcuts. Right. Nothing else.
From Christea Roberts Gallery, this is Making a Mark, a podcast series exploring artists' approaches to drawing and printmaking. I'm Charlotte Mullins.
I've printed woodcuts with a spoon.
Possibly not at 8 foot tall, which I believe is the height of your latest.
No, I wouldn't have done that with a spoon, but it's certainly possible.
Would have just taken a long time.
It's this.
Oh, a wooden spoon.
Yeah, it's that motion.
So you would cut the block and then put the paper over it and literally rub a spoon into the back of it. You can print anywhere.
Oh, yeah.
Even without a press.
Oh, yeah. You don't need the press.
They're all incredibly tactile. You can really feel him gouging into an etching plate or drawing on a lithographic stone. They all have an intensity to them.
Alan Christea, founder and co-director of the Christea Roberts Gallery.
I met Jim for the first time in 1979, so that is 45 years ago. In fact, I can remember the first time I met him because we went and had lunch together at Langan's, and he said he wanted me to take over the representation for distributing his prints in Europe, which I started to do almost immediately. I mean, over the past 45 years, I've always followed in Jim's wake, because wherever he goes, wherever in the world, he makes prints.
There's a printout.
Yeah, let's have a look at it.
But it just came from summer's work in Walla Walla, Washington. Print studio there. And it's an etchy.
I think it's called Rachel and
Morris
Cohen.
Yes.
And they are your grandparents.
They're my grandparents.
It looks like it's on 6 sheets of paper. It's a really long, almost like a Japanese scroll.
It's done over a print that I've been making states of since, I guess, 1977, I think, called Rachel Cohen's Flags, which are iris. And I've taken the plate and then added tools to it. So I made a marriage of my grandparents.
He breaks all the normal printmaking rules. Normally when one does an etching, you get to the point where the etching has been printed and additioned, and then you score through the plate so that no more impressions can be made. But Jim doesn't conform to that at all. He retains all the etching plates, and he will work over the top of previous images that he has made. So, Rachel and Morris Cohen, they were etching plates where the subject matter was a whole row of irises, flag being another word for iris. It was a flower picture. It's still there. The original composition is still there. He's reworked the etching plates and covered the irises in tools.
The tools come from a series I did called History of Communism, maybe 10 years ago, and then I've cut them up off the original plates and then used them in another portrait I did, and now I'm using them here. I mean, they're forever.
So you're layering the different plates.
And also, I'm speaking about my personal printmaking history, which interests me. Mm. I like to look back, and I like to go forward.
And I believe your grandfather had a tool.
He had a
hardware shop.
He had that and plumbing supplies. Yep. I worked there since I was 9. It was called the Save Supply Company. It was chock full of objects of desire. You know, I liked being there. It was a place to daydream.
His mother died when he was very young, and his father wasn't around. So he's really brought up by his grandparents, Rachel and Maurice Cohen. And Maurice Cohen had this tool shop. That was a really important part of his life. And it's when the tools first appeared.
My name is Julia DiMario, and I'm a professional etching printer. I've been working with Jim Dine since about 1990 in various shops, in various situations, always with copper plate etching. He uses them in conjunction with other images, as well as prints that are entirely about tools. They're often collaged. There are many, many tools on the same plate. He may add them a state at a time. In etching, you can start with an image. The printer will then etch and proof the plate and give it back to the artist, in this case, Jim, and he'll add more tools as if he's collaging the images onto the plate, forming a composition. Sometimes they seem rather abstract, but obviously they're recognizable. They're representational, but the composition as a whole could seem somewhat abstract. Sometimes they're combined with portraits or images of Pinocchio, which in a sense is also a portrait, but the tools, they just feel to me like they're part of his vocabulary. It's how he's communicating with his viewers.
Yeah, it must have been quite an experience because...
To do what?
To grow up in that way and then to decide. You went to first to night school and then to art college. Was that a difficult decision? Did the family support that? Or
they thought I was out of my mind. When I got my driver's license when I was 16, I lived with my grandma and grandpa, and he was dying, and I just took the keys and went to art school at night. Gosh. And it certainly saved my life.
Yes.
In those years. And actually, in his basement is where I made my first print. I just took a piece of wood and just a chisel, and it wasn't a gouge. I took a chisel, made a drawing, and carved it and printed it with oil paint, black oil paint. And I was 17, and I was so excited by the results.
I think your first print of using a tool as a motif was 10 years later in 1920, when you were 27. Did that feel a moment to use that as subject matter? Did it feel?
It felt when I did it, it felt very secure. I didn't know what to do. I was offered this opportunity to work at this woman's workshop, the legendary workshop, and it was spur of the moment. She welcomed me and had a litho stone ready, and I just picked up the pliers and drew it.
But from that moment to now, you are still working with that motif. It's still a rich seam for you to work with.
It never goes away. It never goes away. It's in my cultural DNA, if you will. I'm wedded to them.
I remember way back in the 70s, he did a whole series called 30 Bones of My Body, and it was 30 different prints of individual tools. Well, that demonstrates, just in the title, his personal relationship with tools. He has tremendous respect for them, and he's, in a sense, he's paying homage to them. In those early, very finely etched prints, he always stands the tools up, so they become statues. They're like little monuments.
They're in your face. I don't want an aerial view. I don't want a three-quarter view. I like a frontal view of these tools.
And I can see the flag iris is underneath, but in the early stages of this, the early prints you made of this, you painted them in watercolour.
That's right.
I
hand-coloured them. I kept it black and white because the beauty of etching is black and white. The fact is, it's about copper and black ink.
Yeah.
And otherwise, it's about decoration, somewhat. Mm. Hopefully, I transcended that sometimes, but maybe not ever. But when it's black and white, it's the real thing.
What's interesting is that you use big power tools.
I use power tools all the time. And, I mean, now these marks here are from a grinder.
They look like kind of stripes scoured into the surface.
Well, but there's so many different... Well, will abrade the surface will print.
Yeah, and what about up here?
Same.
Because the surface that you can see...
And also the black, this black... Yes. It is not a true black, you see, it's gray.
Yeah.
And that's from the same tool. Whereas this is from the engraved Dremel, which is very black, or this is dry point, and you can feel it with your finger.
So that's how you get the different lines on the print, is using different equipment to make the line?
That is how I get it, yeah.
I love the range of blacks and grays. I love how it almost transcends printmaking into drawing. The way Jim approaches etching, it's very much the way he approaches drawing. And to me, they hover someplace between printmaking and drawing. And every shaped plate that is laid on top of the iris images has a different quality of tone, because each plate from A History of Communism had its own quality of tone. And by tone, I mean the background will print differently depending how the plate was treated in the first place. So you see light grays overlaid with slightly darker grays, and it does feel like transparent layers laid on top of each other. And there's a depth to it that I just love. I love looking at this print as we were printing the plates. I love how it looks as one long piece. It's just very pleasing to the eye.
This is where I tried to erase with a small tool that you fit with the Dremel. But it comes up, unless I worked it by hand and burnished it with oil, it will stay gray like that, which I like. I mean, a lot of this comes from accidents, but it's no accident that I can't control. I'm not interested in throwing the paint.
But you quite like the trace of
I like the trace of my hand, and I like the history that this has in it, and I like the memory of all the printers, some dead, who have worked on this print in the various states.
Yeah.
So it becomes nostalgic, and it becomes one's history.
Yeah, but it exists in your present. Yes. But it has all that laced into it, your grandparents, the printmakers
everything.
Who've worked in it.
But that's who I am. I am a chronicler of my history and of my unconscious and of my past.
It's really stunning.
We hope.
You know, he's an emotional artist. Every picture he does, in a way, is a reflection of his life. It's always a struggle. He's always wanting to do better, to add to this biography of emotions. Because it's not an actual biography, but it traces his moods, his emotions through the years.
And I think at the beginning, when you talked about just wanting to record the tools, after a while you did talk about actually we can read them as different things. So I think sometimes they look like trees or a landscape, or they can evoke different things to us.
Can evoke things that aren't verbal. We bring to it our unconscious and our conscious, and what we see is a tool. And it's really pretty much what it is. If you relate to it in some unconscious way, there's probably no words to describe that.
So we're looking at five paintbrushes, the second state of five paintbrushes. Yeah. So the first state of this print was just five brushes, and they ranged from a thin brush to a much wider, fatter brush. But the hair on them is so delicate and fine. And then the second state, you add another six brushes to it. So we're looking at 11 brushes on it now. They're all hanging up like they're hung on a wall in a workshop.
It's just a frontal image of paintbrushes, but the gas that makes it go is the way the hair of the brush is rendered. And that's quite natural to hard ground etching. And these guys were good printers. And in those days, I didn't really know what I wanted from the etching, so I allowed them to wipe it quite clean of, there was a slight gray background. But now I would have left much more ink on the plate.
This second stage we're looking at has almost a white background, mm-hmm. as you say, but as you go through the stages, it does get darker. So you have experimented with the background in these stages.
I learned a lot about etching from that series.
I love the paintbrushes. The paintbrush handle is left more or less untouched, so they pop out of the image. And then there's aquatint, which is a way of producing a continuous tone, a gray or a black, or a very watery tone on a plate using rosin. The brush bristles are very rich and irregular. I believe they're both hard ground and dry point combined. Hard ground first and dry point on top. So they look very much like brushes that are coming off the page. You just can feel the movement in them.
Each of the states has its own slightly different character. I used to hang the first state in my home, and then at a certain point, I decided to hang the sixth state instead. I get a real tingle out of the precision and the delicacy. For me, it's alive. It's breathing. I mean, I don't know a better draftsman. It's not as if you're sitting there with a pencil. I mean, there are loads of people who can do that and be very good draftsmen. Not in Jim's league, but they can be very good. But if you're doing that on a copper plate, I mean, that is not easy at all to retain that delicacy and that tension.
Around this time, a little bit later than this, maybe 1975, I think, you met, you started working with Aldo Crommelink, who was legendary, worked with Picasso, with Braque.
The guy was an expert. Mm-hmm. He knew everything there was about etching, about printing on metal. Mm. He had standards that were so rigorous that I never came up to them, yet we remained in love.
You worked with so many different great printmakers. Now, when I was reading, you describe working with Kurt Zein and describe working with Aldo. It was like Aldo was the manager or the owner of a very smart car showroom, and Zein was the mechanic in a really messy garage full of noise. And both contributed, when they collaborated with you, to your work in different ways.
Zein was a bull, and he was very rough, very rough. I loved working with him. It was truly a collaboration. With Aldo, you know, you're at the Church of Etching. But with Zein, we were really got down.
And was he more responsive to your use of power tools? Because I think
No, Aldo was not he was not judgmental about it. He was quite amazed, I think. I fucked up his shop a lot with the copper dust. But I remember once I picked up a chainsaw in New York and carved a huge print. They had I think it had five panels. I did it with a chainsaw, a woodcut, and I saw him. He walked by in the hall to getting to his studio, and he and his wife, my friend Pep Crommelink, stood there and watched. I mean, literally, they had their mouths open. They'd never seen anybody make a print with a chainsaw. So, but he was never judgmental about it. He figured, you know, if you get an image, you get an image. No, he was a great guy. Albert was a great guy.
It's incredible to imagine. You've got a giant piece of wood, not even a beautiful piece of wood. I think you've talked about working on packing crates and things like that. And then you've a massive chainsaw in your hand. And you're creating something that in the end is a beautiful, calm print.
Well, I hope so.
Yeah.
I hope so. But I mean, I'll use anything to get what I want. When I saw that chainsaw, I knew it was going to work. It took wide swaths of wood away in a wild way. It was like onomatopoeia. It expressed the working of the chainsaw.
Yes. Was it kind of, did it make a jagged line, or is it a slight element of chance in it?
A splintered line, which picked up ink in a lively way, so that it was like nerve ends.
He's so proficient with these tools, it's almost as if he's holding a paintbrush or a pencil. That's how comfortable he is with the power tools. He just is not tentative. He knows exactly what he wants. And for an etching printer, that is 90% of the battle, to work with a confident artist. And that has been, to me, the greatest gift. Jim knows what he wants. And I then know how to prepare a plate for him, or how to proof for him. I've learned how to print the way Jim wants me to print. And I can bring that confidence that Jim has given me to my other collaborations.
I have an image here called Tools and Dreams, black and white, from 1985, which I think is interesting because, again, we see that mixing of motifs that you're known for, the heart, but with the tools at the bottom, like we've seen the flag irises with the tools.
It's certainly on two plates that I did with Aldo. And then I went back in and printed it probably in New York. But I, more than put the hearts in, I took out things.
So the tools kind of march along the bottom.
Yeah, they do march.
But the middle of the print looks like you've used a power tool to burnish.
I've used the power tool to erase.
And then the heart is dropped on the top of that. Yes. But the background I'm interested in,
the
too.
The background is a result of what's called spitbite. And that was done, I think, with Aldo. He was the master.
Can you describe this? Because I've tried to get my head around it. It does involve spitting.
The printer puts down on the etching plate an aquatint ground, which means he's melted powdered rosin onto the plate, and that makes a very primitive dot pattern. This is all microscopic. So that's all over the plate. And then you use ferric chloride with a brush, and you can paint with it, or in this case, I flipped the brush and spattered it. But the problem is, the ferric chloride bubbles up. It's like oil and water. It doesn't always flow the way you want it to. And you have to spit into what's on the plate, the ferric chloride. The saliva makes it stay and not crawl.
Some people may perceive printmaking to be quite a genteel art, maybe particularly in Aldo's example. But what you're describing is a chainsaw-wielding, spitting artist literally pulling images out of this material first place.
That's just me being dramatic. Honestly, it's a delicate art. You're right.
The finale is a you know, a beautiful print. This print reminds me of the screen you did more recently on a very large scale with a lot of colour.
That's a woodcut.
Asleep with His Tools, yeah. Jim Dreams, from 2019.
Right. And I did that here. Right,
this is like a folding screen that you would have
in
a room.
Correct.
I mean, this is a taller than a person, 5 panels wide. This makes me think of your poetry quite a lot. You put yourself...
That's very nice of you. Thank you. No, really, I understand. I understand what you mean. Because it is a kind of collage technique. Mm. And my poetry is very much built on turning words all different ways and cutting them out and repasting them there and getting to a point where I end up with something. And that was kind of what I did there.
Definitely. It feels like that. Like it's kind of instinctive.
I made it more confused, not confused, but jammed up by the way I painted the paper first in a technicolor way.
So you print on top of the colored paper rather than going over the top?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, I do.
Often the color element, sometimes it's printed, but as often as not, he can't be bothered to wait for the color printing, so he simply colors them by hand because he's always in a hurry. He's always, you know, wants to get on to the next thing, you know, to get better, to move forward. He's got, this quite extraordinary energy.
This is, I'm very excited by this series. Yeah. Can you describe what we're looking at?
Yeah, it's an 8-foot hammer that I carved on a piece of plywood here in the studio, and then I printed it on different grounds. And some of the grounds were just me fucking up the paper. But other grounds are images I had printed, which are usually found images, like from a magazine or something I found on the floor or whatever it is. They are scanned and photographed by the best camera you can buy in the world. So the veracity is amazing.
With the hammers, which he's done recently, he's really kind of challenging the viewer. One tool, huge, central, big marks. And it's almost Jim throwing down a challenge and saying, deal with that. I'm honouring these tools that have been my companions throughout my life. And here they are, really big, really imposing.
I think these hammer prints, they're so scratched by the hammer too. Am I wrong? I mean, to me, I read it almost like a tree. This hammer, right?
It does look like a tree.
It rises up through the central spine.
Well, it's how I carved it.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it's my drawing.
Yes.
Gabby Peckman and Christoph Chavan printed the hammers at Steindruck Studio in Apeldoorn, Austria.
Soft reds and blues.
That was really arbitrary.
Really?
Yeah, I just wanted to call them things.
And,
so I used all, they're all my relatives. It's just a way of immortalizing my relatives.
So we shouldn't read too much into it, like this is your family tree.
No family tree at all. It's just that I didn't know what else to call them. And Gabby Peckman, the printer, said to me, what are the titles of these? We have to have them. So I used the people who I'm linked to.
Yeah.
In my family and my printers.
Who actually printed these works?
Yeah, who printed the works.
Should they read too much into it? The background of theirs looks like a whiteout or a snowstorm.
They didn't read anything into it. They were happy that I was there. Yeah. They are great friends and great, great craftsmen.
Do you work with them because they can print an 8-foot woodcut? I can't believe everyone can do that.
Not everyone can, but they happen to be probably the printers that bring to me whatever is possible, they can do. They are very, very clever and very, very sensitive to what I want and really can print.
He really admires craftsmanship, and so he admires these printers with whom he works. And in that admiration, they become part of his family and they become part of his story, his biography. And he's a real craftsman himself, and so he loves the company of other craftspeople.
I feel like I've grown up with Jim. I started working with him when I was 29 years old, and I'm now 64. So he has been a huge part of my life, and I feel like he's family. I feel very honored to be one of his printers. He's a true inspiration. He will be 90 next June, and I'm in awe of his energy and his drive to create.
I've heard you saying the thing that makes Julie unique is that she prints with heart, not with her head like Aldo did.
Right. She's got it in her hands.
It's instinctive for her.
And she's super intelligent. So she's She's heard me, you know.
Because you've talked about when you work with printmakers, it's a coming together. Like, you learn from each other.
Right.
You don't see it as, like, here's my print, do what I say.
Right.
You only really work with people who you get something.
Yes, who I have a relationship with. Yeah. And if I don't, and we don't get along, I don't do it, you know.
Jim has worked with many different printmakers in Europe and the US over the years, but one unchanged continuum has been selling them with Alan Cristaire for the last four decades.
He's the only dealer I've ever had who transcends being a dealer into a human.
I feel like he's almost like one of the master printmakers you work with, the printers, that he understands print at an instinctive level.
Well, he's so smart that he understands everything, probably.
I mean, he's been incredibly generous to me over the years. You know, he gave all those prints to the British Museum, and I think, you know, one of the most touching moments of my life was when he rang me up and said, I'm giving all these prints to the British Museum. I'm doing so in honour of Alan Cristaire. You know, I mean, that is so touching. I didn't know what to say. It was such a wonderful thing to do. We've been very close over the years. I'm younger than he is, but not by that much. And he's got far more energy than I have. I mean, how can one not take pleasure out of being involved with, you know, such a great printmaker and ultimately, you know, a tremendous human being?
You've been listening to Making a Mark from the Cristaire Roberts Gallery, presented by me, Charlotte Mullins. To find out more about Jim Dine and the work we've been discussing, please visit www.cristaireroberts.com.